Shrink Wrap Radio number 507, Imaginal Figures in Everyday Life, with Dr. Mary Harrell.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is author and Jungian-oriented therapist, Mary Harrell, PhD, and we'll be discussing her book, Imaginal Figures in Everyday Life, Stories from the World Between Matter and Mind. For more information about Dr. Mary Harrell, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in the Neuropsychotherapist is The Psychotherapist's Guide to the Brain, Part 2, which focuses on the limbic system. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. Also, there is a link in the left-hand sidebar that you can click on. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Zipcar.com, where you can earn $25 of free driving credit at www.joinzipcar.com/shrinkwrapradio. And now, let's go to the interview. Dr. Mary Harrell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dave. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, I'm really pleased to have this opportunity. Your publisher sent me a copy of your book, and it really has created a wonderful sort of discovery for me, because I wouldn't have known about you and your work without the book. And I think it's really such a beautiful thing that you've created. So I'm really happy to have you here. And having said that, what inspired you to write this book that we'll be getting into more about? But tell us the background of how you came to write this book.
Okay, well, there are really two things that led up to the writing of my book, which once I started writing it, it took 14 years from beginning to end.
That's one of the things I was going to ask you, was how long it took, because it looked like this was not something that was dashed out overnight by any means.
No. So what happened was, the history of the book is that when I was a 13-year-old girl, 1962, I was one of six children, and my mother went to the hospital to have the seventh child. I never saw her again. She had our seventh child, her seventh child, my sister, and named the baby, held the baby, and then suddenly died through complications that nobody knew about. But the point is, she was the soul of our family, and she was absolutely marvelous. And to have her gone that quickly was just horrible for a 13-year-old girl, as well as my brothers and sisters. And so 2 years after my mom died, I was still grieving and in a very dark and sad place. And I had tremendous responsibility, like more like those suited to a 35-year-old woman. And one night, a figure came to me. She came to my bedroom. I knew she was there. She had not manifested. I couldn't see her. And very slowly, she started to manifest. I was horrified. To me, this was a ghost. And yeah. I didn't want to be dealing, you know, with a ghost. So I figured out a way to make her stop manifesting. She was trying to move toward me to give me a box. And I felt if I took the box, something would be completed that I was frightened of. So I jumped out of bed, which I later learned was me altering my consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I wrapped my arms around my older sister, which was me moving into the material world. But I didn't know any of this. I just wanted that woman out of my life. So that ended that moment. But for 22 years, that woman, who was very kind, I just didn't want any part of her. She kept trying to manifest, trying to come back and make this connection. Then for no reason that I understood at the time, she stopped.
Yeah, wow, what a powerful experience. And I'm realizing that it might be good to give the title of the book, and even for anybody that's seeing this on video, this is in a nice paperback published by Chiron. And the title is Imaginal Figures in Everyday Life. So, and the subtitle is Stories from the World Between Matter and Mind. So, is this an example of what you mean by an imaginal figure?
Absolutely. Do you want me to say what imaginal figures are?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's an important background because imaginal is a word that's kind of sprung up in the Jungian context, and it's not the same as imaginary, which a lot of people might think, oh, that means imaginary.
Correct.
So give us your take on this idea of imaginal.
Henri Corbin was a French philosopher, and he studied Sufi mysticism. And that was would be around the 12th century where his body of research occurred. And he realized that there was this reality that people understood at that time. This was long before the Enlightenment age. 1719 was when that happened. And he wanted to find a word that would differentiate between imaginal, which means a being that's not fully physical, but not something that the mind conceives alone. So it's somewhere between the physical, which is the world of matter, and between the mind, which is the world of ideas.
Yeah, and so I had no idea that that term went back so far. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I thought it was kind of like a new invention. So that's fascinating.
Well, it's new because people are talking about it now and studying and making that differentiation between imaginal, which is the real, which is the reality, but not something supported necessarily by science or reason, and imaginary, which is a flight of fantasy and something of, like it, sometimes we daydream and we're really not daydreaming about anything. We're just kind of escaping a boring lecture or something like that. And so that would be a daydream, and that is most often a fantasy.
I guess one of the distinguishing characteristics of these imaginal figures is that they have a certain amount of autonomy. They seem to have an independent existence beyond your own thoughts or ideas. And I'm thinking here of Jung's Red Book, in which he's got this figure Philemon that he dialogues with.
I love that you're saying this because there are all kinds of imaginal figures, and certainly we all know about dream figures. So we don't invite them. We don't say, I want this nice figure, this pleasant fellow. We get who we get. That's their autonomy, correct?
Yeah, I've tried.
That's right. It doesn't work.
Let me have that good dream figure again, that one that
that's right.
This really now, beautiful girl. Bring her
back. That's right. And if you could do that, then the dream figure wouldn't have an autonomy of its own, but it comes when it wants to come. So Jung, when he did those figures in the Red Book, he was really creating the images of these imaginal beings. And Philemon, which is very interesting, is not just an imaginal figure, but we know from the way Jung spoke about him, he was a psychoid being, meaning this is a very new concept, even in Jungian psychology. Philemon was not symbolic of a part of Jung's personality, but a figure outside of Jung's personality. So he was separate. He wasn't a complex. He wasn't symbolic of a problem. He wasn't a personality aspect that hadn't been figured out yet by Jung, lived out by Jung. He was actually more of a guide or an ally. So my ghost, which later I came to see as an angel, meaning from the Greek messenger, my ghost was also a psychoid figure.
Okay, the psychoid figure is, it's a little bit hard to grasp with my rational mind, but you do say it's from the world between matter and mind. So there's an in-between place there where there's stuff going on that we can't really subject to rational science, I guess.
Correct, correct. If you're studying the unconscious, think of the unconscious. It's a place of irrationality, darkness, chaos. It's always unreasonable, and it's infinite. So how are you going to study it objectively? You really can't. The only way you get at the imaginal realm is through experience. If I can say that what Jung taught us was this notion of staying with the image until, as he says, his phrase for it is, stay with the image until you come to terms with the unconscious. And he says that might take a moment and it might take years. Mm-hmm. And how he did it, how he stumbled upon this is what we call active imagination. So Jung says, as you stay with the image, maintain a self-reflective ego attitude. That's the key. So you're not really asleep, because when you're asleep, your ego disappears.
Yeah.
So he called that process, that method, active imagination. And how he got to it was, he was going through a very difficult time around, I think it was 1912, 13, 14, right after he broke with Freud. And he, because he was highly intuitive, he started playing with stones like he had as a young boy. Mm-hmm. And as he played with these stones, thoughts came to him, images came to him, ideas, problems, fantasies started coming to him. And he realized that if he stayed with these images that were coming as he played, he did that as an expressive activity. He realized that he was coming to terms with the unconscious. So you know how so many therapists today will have expressive therapies, art, dance,
sure.
Sculpting?
Yeah.
That is what Jung taught us, because all of those things let us access the unconscious.
Yes. Now, you point out that even despite the autonomy that's in that image and some of the others that you're going to be sharing with us, that imaginal mm-hmm. figure, that it is related and anchored in some ways to your life very explicitly, mm-hmm. That these arose during times of real crisis, mm-hmm. and very, you know, shaped by the fact that your mother had died, and so that you were in a sense orphaned. And you mm-hmm. talk about the archetypal impact on your life, where I think you mentioned three primary archetypes, if I remember correctly. It was the abandoned orphan child, the great mother, and death. Do I remember that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Boy, you're good. You got them. Well, they're the three big archetypes.
Thank you. Yeah. So
that
big
we're
archetype.
Swimming around in all of this.
Yeah. So there's that whole archetypal superstructure or undergirding, whatever, that is moving in your life and very, very influential. And amidst everything that's going on in your very packed life, mm-hmm. you also, at some point, you're in a Jungian-oriented graduate program, which is stirring the pot. Mm-hmm. You're in Jungian therapy. Mm-hmm. Also stirring the pot.
That's right.
You've got divorces and marriages.
Right.
Stirring
the second
the pot.
Abandonment issue pops up. That's right. All of that was going on when this research was being done.
Yes. And so the this book is structured around seven pivotal life stories or crises. And you write about them so beautifully that I thought a good way for us to structure this interview mm-hmm. would be for you to choose a passage to read so that my listeners can hear the beauty of your writing. And then so you would read a passage from the introduction and the four successive chapters, one each, and then maybe we could use that as a springboard to get into whatever comes up, whatever feels that it's important for us to do.
Okay.
So with that, why don't you launch us with whatever passage you've chosen from the introduction?
Okay. Now, this first one is kind of getting my reader focused on what the questions are that will be answered as I look at these seven stories. And these are questions that are fairly new to the field. So here, I'll give this piece of reading. The reading is in two parts. The second part, as I started writing the book, a figure came in a dream. And I also felt that she was a very special figure. So I talk about how I wonder about her and how I work with her image, because that's what we want to do when we're looking at the imaginal.
Okay.
So here we go. I'm often asked, to what end do you pursue your many questions about the Mundus Imaginalis? These questions include, in what ways might the imaginal realm manifest? Can one cause it to appear? Does a world as vast as the imaginal possess common threads, perhaps common intention or a common source? How might one relate to a subtle presence? That would be my angel. My answer is always the same. I ask these questions for the sake of soul in the world. My ultimate aim is to provide avenues of entry to the imaginal domain for many thoughtful readers who are not Jungians but wish to understand the mysteries of the unconscious within the context of their own life. I open this introduction section by sharing the ways in which I came to explore imagination and her images. Simply put, I had the idea to write this book, and I talk about my mother's dying, but there was a second piece. The second piece was when I entered my scholarly work to become a Jungian psychotherapist, I discovered a lens with which I could look at the imaginal realm. So now I'm going to stop there and talk about, kind of share the reading where the reader and I kind of get to see me working with this Japanese dancer who was in this dream that came mm-hmm. at the beginning of the book.
Okay.
This is how I knew when this dream came. This is how I knew this is the work I was supposed to do. In a sentence or two, the dream opens and I'm in a beautiful garden, but it's very neglected. It's clear that some loving gardener has been here and structured it and designed it, but the gardener's no longer working. I'm on a porch, and next to me is my family. I see this extraordinary Japanese dancer. My family doesn't see her. And I'm thinking, why do I see her and they don't? So I talk about this in this little piece where I'm really wondering about the Japanese dancer. This is how we would wonder about an imaginal figure. I see a young girl dressed in Japanese classical garments. What's most striking is that the numinous quality of the girl's movements, her grace, her blending of music, form, body, soul, and spirit, are not of this world. In the dream, I struggle to find some way to organize this otherworldly experience. I'm frustrated because I try to experience it with my senses and my knowledge of the world. In other words, with matter and mind. And let's see where I am. And I find that those capacities are inadequate. My frustration, though, is nothing in light of the wonder and beauty of her dance. I knew as I watched that her dance transcended that which my material senses perceived. In the dream, it was the bodily gestures within the dance that deepened the experience of the imaginal world. The gesture, linking affect and image, brought a sense of awe. As I witnessed her, I remember knowing that I was in the presence of a figure unlike any other I had encountered before. I could, at least within the dream, experience her, feel the otherworldly marvel of her dance, her soulful aliveness, her elegant innocence, and her unmolested beauty. This dancer seemed to be a figure, a guide, from outside of my own psyche. I awoke knowing that such a dance could not come from me alone, as my mind and body are bounded by the limitations of my own human nature. She, with her extraordinary presence, was a figure more fantastic than any human figure could be. And I'll stop there. But one thing I say later on that I'll just make a sentence about is that I figured out that the reason my family couldn't see her is that my family in the dream represented the larger social order that we all live in, the modern society, that really can't see a lot of the enchantment and the imaginal in their daily life because they're not open to this realm.
Yeah.
They dismiss it.
Yeah. So I imagine what you did with this image was to dialogue with her a lot and use the kind of techniques that have evolved in dream work of keeping a journal and maybe drawing in it and dialoguing and kind of holding that figure.
That's right.
And as you were reading, I was thinking of some of the other elements that we may not get to in this conversation here, which were so so interesting to me, is the life that you were leading, where you, for part of it, you're living in a very desolate place in Northern California, somewhere around Mount Shasta.
Mm-hmm. North of Mount Shasta, yeah.
And you've got a wolf.
I have a Mexican red wolf, yes.
I've never heard of a Mexican red wolf, but this is an actual wolf that you have, like a dog, but it's a wolf?
Right. Well, he was 85% Mexican red wolf, 15% German shepherd.
Sounds like a lovely combination.
Yeah, yeah. He was. It was Kara, a girl, a she-wolf. And yes, we had her since she was a little baby. And we lived in an area called the High Desert of Northern California. So you could really get away with things like that there.
Yeah. So there were a variety of wild experiences that were happening for you. The wolf herself seems like a kind of numinous figure, even though she's of flesh and blood in this real world. And you were having encounters with nature in that Northern California locale because there weren't people around and you were living with this wolf.
Right.
And I got you probably look different than you look now. I'm imagining you as you were a pretty young woman.
I was. And, I was in my 30s when I got Kara.
And a little bit of a wild woman is the sense I get. And so I'm wondering how you, with all of this, these very powerful conflicts that were in your life, you know, these things tend to constellate around wounds in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
And you certainly had some wounds in your life, starting with the loss of your mother, and then having to be the adult, taking mm-hmm. care of the mm-hmm. other siblings and all. At what point did you discover Jungian psychology and get a sense that, oh, this is going to be a fit for me? When did that mm-hmm. happen?
Mm-hmm. When I was in Northern California, I was a teacher. I taught for 30 years in the K-12 setting and then for 10 years at the college level. And there were these two individuals that I met. One was a psychologist who came to work in our schools with this comprehensive program we had, and a second was a school nurse. And they were, to me, extraordinary people. And I asked both of them, tell me a little bit about yourself. You just seem unusual. Mm-hmm. And both of them said, blah, 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 blah. And I went to Pacifica Graduate Institute, which I had never heard of.
Yeah.
So, okay, flash forward to this moment in my life where my husband literally disappeared. He went into the desert of Arizona, and he wouldn't tell me for 3 years where he was. I thought he was having a breakdown. But really what happened was our marriage was over, and that's the bizarre way he dealt with it. But he would let me call him if I had like a tax question, but he wouldn't really talk to me. And he literally said, family is something, is a burden that I don't want right now. So there I was. This is a life in shipwreck. Thank goodness, professionally, I worked all my life, so I'm still teaching. And one day I sat, because I'm a very intuitive person, I sat at the base of these big stairs in this home I lived in California, and I said to myself, my daughter had left at this time to go to Fordham University in Manhattan. She always wanted to study drama, and they had a performance program at a Manhattan campus. So she was gone. My husband had disappeared, and I'm waiting for him, thinking, I didn't figure out for a while he left. I just thought he was having a nervous breakdown or something.
Yeah.
And so I sat at the base of my steps in my home, and I just said to myself, if you had no family obligations, which actually I didn't for the first time in my life, and if money were no object, this is my question. I said, what would you want to do? I asked that of myself. And boom, like a flash of lightning, here's the answer.
Wow.
Go to Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Wow.
And I called them up and I said, is it too late to apply? And when does class start? And I got in.
And had you had no therapy up to that point?
I really had, because my life was so full of these tragedies, the loss of my mother and other things. I had a little boy who died right after birth, and I had a total of 5 pregnancies, and I only have 1 baby that grew up, my daughter Lauren. So there's a lot of sadness there.
Yeah.
So I bet off and on, I hate to give it a number, but I'm going to try. I bet I was in therapy with some very fine therapists. Probably, I'm almost 70 now. So I think I was in therapy for about 37 years, off and on.
Off and on.
Thank goodness. Yeah. They helped me develop my strong ego, which is what allows me to do this imaginal work without becoming psychotic. Mm-hmm. I'm just so grateful for them. And one therapist in particular, I told him about that angel who visited for so many years. And I had a wonderful aunt who was very good to me, but she was a psychiatric nurse. And she said, Mary, do not tell anybody about that angel. I said, why not? She said, because they'll think you're psychotic. So I didn't ever tell anybody. And then I was working with a therapist, and I told him about the angel. And I said, do you think she was real? And he wasn't a Jungian or anything like that. And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, I don't know. And that was the most beautiful thing anybody said to me, because I could continue kind of holding in consciousness that I did have this figure visiting me, and I was functioning beautifully in every other way, so I don't think I was ever psychotic. But my therapists were beautiful guides to me.
Boy, we never know what it is that we say that will touch someone.
That's right. That's right. I'm just so grateful to all these therapists I had. I moved a lot because of my husband's work. He was a school superintendent. And their tenure in office is like 2 to 3 years. It's a real stressful job. And so I would get a new therapist when I moved. I just consider them to be my guides, and my material guides in the material world. And I suspect, remember I said the angels stopped coming at when I was 37?
Yes.
Yeah, I was 37 when the angel stopped coming. And I suspect she stopped because this beautiful work with these therapists had really done for me the guiding work that my mother would have done had she not died. Mm. And then the angel stopped
coming.
And
that angel was trying to give you a box. Mm-hmm. And at some point you, I think, said that you got an intimation of what that gift was that she was trying to give you that you were pushing away.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I talk about that in part one of the book, I think. Yes, it's a section called Images in Reverie. And I say that what that was about, I figured out by studying, looking deeply and asking the kinds of questions we're talking about. I figured out that She was what we call the spirit end of the archetype of death. And she was the spirit end of the mother archetype. I was the orphan end of that same archetype. And so she wasn't my mother, but she was a nurturing, guiding mother figure. And what the box symbolized was that if I had not been so afraid of her and we could have dialogued, she would have taught me the many beautiful things in life that my own mother might have taught me had she not died. Mm-hmm. And I think of symbolically the box. It looked like the small box a boy gives you at your first prom.
Okay.
And in the box is the corsage.
Uh-huh.
And when you put that corsage on, this is symbolic of you entering the world of the young woman. It's a very formalized way that our culture has to take women and young men into their courting days and into their adulthood, really.
Right.
And so that's what I associate with that box, and that's what she wanted to bring me. But my ego was not strong enough mm-hmm. to really handle that. Another girl, another 15-year-old girl might have done okay with that, but I just had too much trauma in my life. I couldn't manage it.
Yeah, that's interesting that at that point you couldn't manage it, but as you matured and as you dealt with your issues in therapy and within yourself, it resolved.
Yes, it did resolve. And that's why she stopped coming.
Yeah, and
she
that's when she stopped coming.
Yeah.
Now, there's so much in your book, and I'm probably going to end up violating the structure I laid out in the beginning.
That's fine.
Because we're going to run out of time here. And so I'm going to leap way ahead towards a much further point in the book. A person having listened to what we've been saying so far would not guess that you would engage large social issues mm-hmm. with this approach.
Correct.
But you write about school shootings and violence. And so tell us about that and how that articulates with this imaginal world, because just take us through that.
Okay. First of all, I'm so grateful you've asked this question, because when people say to me, what was the biggest surprise for me in writing the book? The answer is that section on the school shootings. That was not my intention to go there.
Yeah, really. I know. It's surprising.
So the thing is, one of the scholars that has deeply influenced my life is James Hillman, mm-hmm. and he is the father of archetypal psychology. So he and people who follow in his footsteps in scholarships like Robert Romanishin, they are telling us if the individual is an ensouled being, so if we have an unconscious, so too does the culture. And I see it in the school settings all the time. So in our modern Western culture, we're very puritanical about our moves regarding sexuality. So there was a goddess Baobo, pre-Greek, who was very lusty, and we still see her in some European cathedrals, and she's like a frog with her legs spread out, and she's all about sexuality and fecundity and all.
What's her name again?
Baobo.
B-A-L-B-O?
B-A-O-B-O. She's in the glossary of the imaginal figures. If you want to look her up, I could look her up too, but we don't want to take the time. But I pronounce it Baobo.
Okay, Baobo.
And in our schools, for instance, so talking about how schools have a soul and school cultures have a shadow and a conscious part, if a girl gets into over-sexualized behavior in the schools, that's a shadow aspect of our culture, and so she gets pushed down. In other words, socially, she's not acceptable. We have mm-hmm. all kinds of names for girls like
right.
that. And really, if we allowed people to be more open about their sexuality, we wouldn't have to have it so much in darkness. So, for instance, if parents are not embarrassed and they talk to their children about sexuality, you're less likely to have a girl acting out the Baobo figure for the whole school culture. And then we have the hero athletes, which that's the conscious part of the school culture. And the heroes we love. So they get pep rallies and they get adulation and they are like the young gods of the school setting. So I learned from Hillman and Romanishin and others that we don't want to ignore what's happening in the culture because it also has symbolism and it also has figures that we want to look at. Well, because I'm a teacher, I've been a teacher for 40 years, my heart, and I'm not alone in this regard, my heart breaks daily every time that, well, weekly now, there's a school shooting.
Yeah.
And you have these young men who leave their home. Often they shoot their parents. They come into the school setting. They shoot the, you know, classmates and sometimes teachers. And then the media narrows it down to two issues. The media says they're evildoers, boom, no thought about any suffering on their part or their own pathology or what caused this. And then the media tells us this is a gun issue. And certainly it is a gun issue, but it doesn't stop there and it doesn't start there. So what I did as an archetypal scholar was I said, all right, I'm going to tell the story of what it was like for me as a teacher experiencing this larger cultural phenomenon, which was the school shootings. And then I analyzed this phenomenon like you would analyze a cultural dream. So I said, well, what are the images that come up for me when I think about this? I think I see guns. I see boy shooters. I see Eric and Harris from the Columbine shootings. I see a picture in my head of this painting I saw as a young girl. It was Picasso's Guernica. And that's a painting of Spain during the Civil War.
Right.
So he brought us the grotesque image of war, the unconscious part of war, before we had television. So that image comes up. So I just allowed myself to be open to what images populated this cultural dream. And then I paid attention to the associations. You know, what do I know about guns? Well, they're metal weaponry. We know if there's a metal weaponry or any metal in a dream, psyche is saying this is something that psyche cannot digest. So in a dream, you don't want a metal tree growing out of the ground. That's not a good sign. You want a trunk of a tree, a normal, natural trunk of a tree growing out of the ground. And so I looked at all this, and what I came up with was that psyche actually said, this is what's wrong. This is what's constellating all together to end up in this insane series of school shootings. It's as if, you know, as a psychologist yourself, you know that if a client comes in and they cannot tell the difference between a dream symbol and a concrete being. So in a dream, there's a lady with her head on fire and he's sitting with you and he says to you, she's in this room and her head is on fire. And he means that in a concrete way. He's not talking about a dream image. You start suspecting that he may be psychotic, correct?
Right. Yeah.
So I was looking at these dream figures as figures that have become concretized in the culture. And they are very concrete deaths, of course. So I said, you know what? This is a pathology and something in the culture is psychotic. What is it? And what I came up with is the shadow of our culture has a violent component that is so massive that we can't look at it. And these young boys happen to be at the cusp of manhood. So whenever we're at the cusp of some great change, we are more vulnerable to an archetype, national violence, coming into us and possessing us. And so that's one of the, that's why they're young boys. And that's why they're boy shooters, because boys have this testosterone going on and they're trying to figure it out and they're very vulnerable about their identity and all of that. Now, if you get to be the hero, you get to live the hero archetype in your high school, you're not that vulnerable because you have this sense of identity, which will broaden and as you mature. But these boy shooters don't have that.
Well, there's kind of a anti-hero opportunity for them, right? An anti-hero. An anti-hero can also be powerful and strike awe in people, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, and come out of the shadows.
So that's a kind of opportunity to get back, to show them.
You know? That's right. That's right. And then, but the dream was also suggesting, the question was, what part does the culture play in this?
Yeah.
And so I started looking at other cultures that don't have this phenomena. And you see places like Papua New Guinea, which even today, they'll have a group of men who initiate the young boys. It's not a like a warped, sick initiation like we see in gang warfare and gang membership, but it's the true elders of the tribe. And these boys go in to these huts away from the mothers, away from the girls, and they go only when they're ready. When they want to go. So they're different ages. And they literally get scarred by these men.
Yep.
And they have on their back these alligator scars. Now, to our culture, that seems like, what's that about? That's who wants to suffer that way? But it's a symbolic initiation, and the old men who are there with them and tend them and support them know that these young men, when they come out of this initiation week or so, I forget how long it takes, they're going to go back to their tribe, and no matter whatever happens to them in their life, they're going to remember that they were held and supported, and most importantly, that they survived. And that when they come back to the tribe, they're seen as heroes. So our young men in our culture don't really have this being held by the elders. The only place I could find it where it was very visible was when people go to AA meetings. My husband, I'm happy to say my current husband, he is, this year he will mark 29 years of sobriety. So he goes to AA meetings on a regular basis. And he has described how people treat each other at these meetings. And I think that's the closest thing I can come to where more vulnerable people in the group are held by those elders. Mm-hmm. And they're suffering, but they reach a point where they say, I've done this. I'm a different man. My husband is a transformed man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He'll tell you that.
Fascinating. Yeah. You know what? I'm aware of the clock and we could just go on and on and on. And so I want to invite you to share another one of the readings that you had thought about, and it doesn't have to be sequential. So why don't you go to one that feels really compelling to you at this moment?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to read one, and you could let me know at any time if this is going on too long, but this is another dimension of the imaginal realm that I wanted to bring out, and it's not about suffering. It's about how one can experience the natural world after one is transformed. I easily move in and out of this kind of place now. I can almost say, well, I don't have to prepare for a presentation or I don't have to clean my house, so I'm just going to go out into nature and enjoy the vivid life that's there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read a piece where I was doing that.
Yeah, good. I think I might remember that section. It was very beautiful. So,
and I'm not going to read the whole thing.
It
should flow together, but it's kind of shorter. Sinking into a green Adirondack chair near my upstate New York garden, my coffee hour begins. Perhaps more accurately, this is my sacred time. Having returned from the gym, I'm pleased to be done with my duty to good health. Almost before the cup reaches my lips, just as a light breeze tickles the curve of my cheek, a grand exhale erupts from within, a signal that some enchantment is about to unfold. As it often does, when I agree to allow a true exchange between the natural world and myself. As if directed by some playful imp, my attention darts to the space between the ground and the sky, where a riotous dance ensues. The trees around me, cherry, silver maple, Alberta spruce, are awash with life, singing in fabulous frenzy. Brilliantly orchestrated, a rhythm begins. A first whisper builds with the speed of an approaching train until the dance between the leaves and the wind bursts into a loud chorus, each belonging to a prescient multivocal community. With each repetition, a first whisper of a breeze, an insistent stirring, the crescendo whoosh ending with leaves whipping through the air, a vivid anticipation of life is both born and realized, not in the grand gesture of the Rocky Mountains, but in the beauty of a refined dance step, each building upon the one before, each creating its own hunger for the next. How does this gorgeous enchantment become itself? As the dancer needs the music, so too does the leaf need the wind. As the dancer needs the troop, so too does the leaf need a thousand sister leaves. Being here this morning in the role of audience extraordinaire, thoughts intrude like uninvited guests. Here comes the mind, wanting to have its questions asked and answered. Who makes this moment thus? Who creates this spirited dance? What exquisite divine allows such beauty to present herself to me, a simple coffee drinker in an Adirondack chair? An answer comes as I gaze up, almost blinded by a shock of sun bouncing behind high branches. Simply accept this gift. Listen as the song of each rustling branch fills you. Hear an army of field grasshoppers scratching rasped legs against tiny wings and birds too many to count, announce from the woods beyond that they're here too. Experience all of this, even as the leaves, first low, then insistent, then wildly alive, repeat their song. Don't miss any of it. And then the last piece I'll read from this is, I have become a participant in an animated sensate world. Though I sit stationary in my chair, I amazingly find myself rustling loudly through a thousand maple branches. I experience whispers of light caught in the midst of dancing grasses, each blade an outfielder catching a ball in the curve of a gloved hand, at once surrendering to the moment of contact and also holding the ball in the mid-center, firm and sure. And it comes to an end.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you chose that little piece to read because it's so evocative. It put me there when I read it, and you paid such exquisite attention to each little detail to kind of paint this very lovely, powerful, transcendent moment. And so it's good for our listeners to know that this, while there's much of your pain in this book, there are also these moments of real beauty, of, I guess, the payoff of all that's this therapy payoff, and all right. of this inner work that you've done.
Yeah, that's my big message. Don't give up on life. We all suffer. You know, I'm really not special. I've worked now for 8 years with my own psychotherapy patients. I know that people suffer horribly. And if we can stay conscious instead of moving to drugs or alcohol or running away with activity, we are transformed, and that pain becomes compassion. That's the beauty.
Yeah. That would be a nice place to wrap it up, but we've got a little bit more time here. So you're talking about being a Jungian-oriented therapist who's gone through all of this, and what I got from a little bit of your discussion about that in the book was your ability to hold a lot of pain when somebody's in a very painful place. And because you've been there, and you've learned not to push the river, but that you have to sit with it with them. Yeah, maybe say more about that. That's what struck me.
It's my belief that all psychotherapy is grief work.
And say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, people usually come to us because they're in pain. And they stay with us because they believe that something is, that either they're being held as they're in that pain, and then hopefully if they stay for a time, that pain starts to resolve, to transform, and become something else. And so my goal when I work with my clients is to not try to do the thing that I tend to do as a nurturing person and as a psychotherapist. I want to heal them and fix them. Yep. And what I try to do is resist that and instead walk with them in their pain. I know that I have been to hell many times. And hell means you're in a place where the pain is so massive, your normal skills and your psychological structures and your way of handling the world, they don't work for you. And so you have nothing but to be in that pain. In my case, I was in hell seeking my mother for many years. I just wanted her back. And I've worked with mothers whose sons have committed suicide, and they just want their boys back. So when you're that way and you haven't yet adapted to a new life without this thing you wanted so bad you thought you would die, it's so helpful to have somebody walking in hell with you. And that's what I find that I do best as a therapist. Wherever they go, I go with them. And I try to give the message, I know hell. I'm not afraid of it. I will walk to any part of hell with you, and we will both come out together.
I think that's a beautiful place for us to wrap it up. That's a great statement. And Dr. Mary Harrell, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Dr. Dave, you've been marvelous. I'm so pleased that you asked me to do this interview. It's been a joy for me. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm afraid we were only able to scratch the surface of Dr. Mary Harrell's book in this interview. Although it's only 143 pages, it covers so much ground and in such deep, soulful prose that it's not easy to encapsulate in an hour-long discussion. That last passage that she read from the book about tuning into nature around her as she was having her coffee break in an Adirondack chair gives you a sense of the quality of her writing, not the kind of thing you can just tear through. This is a book I would highly recommend for anyone interested in the Jungian approach, or anyone who is interested in the sort of imaginal figures she discusses in our interview. It's also an excellent book for anyone interested in archetypes and the archetypal psychology of James Hillman. It's an excellent book for both Jungian-oriented psychotherapists and clients who are in Jungian-oriented therapy. It's a very autobiographical book, as well as a theoretical one. I am amazed by the degree to which she has exposed her soul, her psychology, and the deep pain she struggled with for so many years. We discussed that a bit after the interview, and she admitted that it did take courage and a leap of faith to expose herself so completely. You might be interested in some earlier interviews that would further illuminate her work. Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 290, Ally Work with Jungian analyst Jeffrey Raff, PhD, who is one of her mentors, and episode number 391, James Hillman's Archetypal Psychology with Jungian analyst Patricia Berry, who was James Hillman's wife. As always, you can use our Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site to order Imaginal Figures in Everyday Life, Stories from the World Between Matter and Mind by Mary Harrell, PhD, or you can just click on the icon for her book, which you'll also find in the right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Faye calling from London, UK. Thanks so much for doing the work that you're doing. More than happy to throw $5 your way. Absolutely worth it, and I know I won't miss it. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, Faye, there in London. And I'm happy to report that we do have some new donors or repeat donors. My sincere thanks go out to Lois Williams, Sven Urban Fellner, T.S. Hance, Ethan Winter, Faye Hodge, Yusel Ersatz, and H.D. Hamilton. By the way, you may recall that Barbara Harris, in last week's interview on medical marijuana, mentioned a documentary on YouTube about the Israeli scientists who first discovered THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana, along with at least 100 other potentially healing molecules. You may think you know everything about marijuana. I sort of thought I did, but I learned a lot from watching this YouTube, and I want to recommend it to you all. The easiest way to find it is to go to YouTube and search on The Scientists THC. So three words, The Scientists THC. It's a fascinating story, and I guarantee you'll learn a lot you didn't know. I received an email from listener Gregory asking me why Shrink Wrap Radio isn't on Google Play Music. Well, I didn't even realize there was such a possibility, and no wonder, because that possibility had only been available for about a week and a half. So with Gregory's prompting, I applied and was accepted, and the podcast is now available on Google Play Music in the podcast area. Just go to Google Play Music in your browser and do a search for Shrink Wrap Radio, three separate words. My good friend Dr. Dale Ironson suggested I ask that you all go and listen to at least one episode there in order to drive up our popularity on that platform and thereby bring in new listeners. That's not a bad idea. So let's all give it a try, okay? I've put up a banner ad in the left-hand sidebar reminding all you professionals that you can get 10% off on all the APA continuing education materials at the Zur Institute, not just the courses based on my interviews. You can click on that banner or simply go to zurinstitute.com, search through their extensive catalog, and then use my discount code at checkout, which is Dr. Dave 88, that's DRDAVE88. Once again, I'm happy to welcome Zipcar.com as a new sponsor. I think that car sharing is potentially good for the planet, and that's why I'm happy to add them as a sponsor. Here's a little more information about them. For one thing, Zipcar is the world's largest car sharing network, providing wheels when you want them in 500 plus cities and towns, 500 plus colleges, and 50 plus airports. Zipcar offers over 50 makes and models of cars that range from environmentally friendly hybrids, EVs and PHEVs, to luxury vehicles, to SUVs, pickup trucks, and cargo vans. It's a cost-effective alternative to car ownership. Zipsters pay only for the time they actually use the vehicle, and they have no responsibility for additional costs and hassles associated with car ownership. And you can drive car by the hour or day with gas and insurance included. Zipcars are interspersed throughout local neighborhoods where they are parked in reserved parking spaces and garages within an easy walk of where members live and work. Zipsters can book a designated vehicle using their mobile device through Zipcar's website or by phone, unlock the selected vehicle with their Zipcard, and drive away. So you can earn $25 of free driving credit if you'll just go to www.joinzipcar.com/shrinkwrapradio. So go there and at least sign up, and you never know when you might need to use it.
Hi, this is Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, Jungian analyst, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jungian analyst Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, who was my guest on episode number 284, where she discussed a Jungian vision to save the planet. Now let's go to some recent communications from our listener community. First, we hear from Lucy, who writes, I came across the podcast while searching for psychology podcasts. What can I say? Learning is a passion, and I'm exploring different sources of information. I bought the DSM-5 purely because I heard a diagnosis that didn't sound right and wanted to check it out for myself. Interesting read, though, if that can be said. I also bought Courtney Armstrong's book, The Therapeutic Aha, because I genuinely admire her candid approach. I am of the opinion that you can never have enough brain candy in your life. Long term, though, I think that by keeping an open mind about treatment options, it will make me a better therapist, and I believe the therapist should adapt to the client and work in a manner that gives them a safe space to open up. Having been on the other side of that equation, having a warm and compassionate therapist makes all the difference. Have you done a show from the client's perspective? I think that would be an interesting contrast. Perhaps by all means, feel free to read the email. Please, by all means, feel free to read this email. Just to help you out, my background is Croatian, so the surname is pronounced Abrelić, or maybe it's Abrelić. Have a wonderful day, and that's from Lucy Abrelić, who, if I recall correctly, I believe is writing from the UK, maybe even London. And I did get back to Lucy, letting her know that I have done some interviews from the patient's perspective and recommended the most recent one to her. Next, we hear from Jennifer, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I wanted to thank you for the incredible access to a wealth of information this past year since I've been doing a postdoc at Sonoma State University. I have a very long commute down from Ukiah every day and have enjoyed you and your guests' company on my drive. I've been happily applying knowledge gained from the podcast and my service to the students on campus. Putting out a couple of areas I would love to see explored on the podcast. One of my areas of specialty is process-oriented group work, and I would love to hear group therapy explored on the podcast. There are some pretty incredible researchers and clinicians doing amazing work these days. The application of attachment theory has been particularly fascinating in recent years. I would also enjoy hearing interviews on diversity topics as well, that is, working with diverse populations, the intersection of therapists as social justice advocate, specialized work with particular identities, etc. As an early career psychologist, it is truly incredible to learn from leading experts and researchers on the podcast. Thank you again for making this wealth acceptable to all. And that's from Jennifer E. Lotz, Psy D. And so it was delightful to hear from someone who's actually working at Sonoma State University, where I taught for so many years. And she's there interning in the counseling center. And we had a little email exchange back and forth, and she made a couple of recommendations for future interviews for people involved in group work. So I may well be following up on that sooner or later. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Mary Harrell, for so intimately sharing her journey with imaginal figures. My next interview will be something different. I'll be speaking with Chris Edgar and Jennifer Page, who have produced a soon-to-be-released feature-length film on the phenomenon of cutting. The film's title is Breaking Out, and moreover, it's a rock musical. So I think you'll want to check this one out. And until then, This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.